the headlines, Afghan officials say Kabul University has come under militant attack ahead of the opening of an Iranian book fair. People in Indonesia and Bangladesh hold fresh rallies to condemn the recent Islamophobic campaign in France. And U.S. President Donald Trump again questions the integrity of Tuesday's presidential election as his rival, Democratic rival, rather, maintains a solid national lead in the polls. Hello and welcome, everybody. Unidentified gunmen have opened fire inside Kabul University, forcing students to leave the campus. Officials say an explosion and gunfight happened when Afghan and Iranian officials were inaugurating a book exhibition at the university. They say the gunmen traded fire with security forces on the campus following a blast in the area. At least six people are said to be wounded. The Ministry of Interior also confirmed the gunshots and deployment of police there. No group has so far claimed responsibility for the attack. Afghanistan says terror attacks in the past 50 days have claimed the lives of hundreds of civilians and injured hundreds of others. The attacks come as the intra-Afghan talks have so far failed to bear any meaningful results. I mean, all your reports from Kabul.
The past 50 days proved deadly for all in Afghanistan. Official figures state that over 3,000 individuals, including civilians, government forces, and Taliban militants, have been killed or injured as a result of escalating clashes across the country.
The Taliban has a set of violence across some provinces over the recent month. For instance, 863 civilians were killed or wounded as a result of nearly 2,000 offensive moves carried out by the Taliban.
Experts believe the prospect for peace is limited unless Afghans prevent foreign players from what they call manipulating the decision-making process and instead take the real leading role in the peace talks.
There would be no optimism on peace as long as the decisions on these issues are made either in Washington and Paris or in London and Moscow. Whenever we Afghans take the leading role of the process, we can be hopeful. Secondly, the peace talks in Qatar is a US-led process in itself.
This comes as the firsts are underway by representatives of the Afghan government and Taliban to remove the obstacles on the way of the ongoing intra-Afghan talks and to reach an agreement on the main agenda of the negotiations.
The Afghanistan
meetings between contact groups of the delegation of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and Taliban are underway, but they have not reached a proper agreement on the main agenda of talks so far. Both sides are doing their best to gain a positive result in this regard.
The United Nations recently expressed concern over civilian deaths and the upsurge of violence in Afghanistan, condemning the attacks that lead to the loss of civilian lives.
Besides civilians, the rise of violence in Afghanistan has killed or wounded over 2,000 Taliban militants, including some of their key commanders and dozens of Afghan military forces over the last 50 days. This comes as the Afghan military has stepped up its aerial and ground operations against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban. Syed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Elsewhere, Muslims hold mass demonstrations in Indonesia and Bangladesh to denounce French President Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam comments. Some 50,000 people participated in the anti-Macron rally in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. Also, thousands of Indonesians have gathered near the French embassy in Jakarta, chanting anti-Macron slogans. Earlier this month, Macron's support for blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad angered Muslims around the world. It triggered demonstrations and boycotts of French goods in Muslim countries. And Election Day is getting close in the United States. Republican President Donald Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden have been traveling across the country to win America's vote. The election comes amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and the economic crisis that has engulfed the country. Biden maintains a national lead in the polls, but Trump is right behind him, especially in key swing states.
On Tuesday, Americans will head to the polls for the 59th quadrennial presidential election. In the final day of campaigning, the two rivals are doing their utmost to win the vote.
You are so lucky I'm your president. You are so lucky.
And this is the most important election of our lifetime.
Both Trump and Biden are making a final play for states Republicans won in 2016 ahead of Tuesday election. Their battle for presidency hit the road in recent days. In several instances, Trump supporters disrupted traffic, and in one occasion in Texas, they surrounded a Biden campaign bus. The U.S. president praised all those actions and called his supporters patriots. On the Democratic side, former President Barack Obama came to assist Biden in his campaign trail.
I understand you're not going to control the pandemic, but you know who will? Joe Biden will.
But Trump assured his supporters that there would be a great red wave of Republican victories next week. He also once again raised the prospect of electoral fraud, including in swing states.
I think it was a terrible decision for our country, and I think it's a very dangerous decision. Because you're going to have one or two or three states, depending on how it ends up, where they're tabulating ballots, and the rest of the world is waiting to find out. And I think there's great danger to it, and I think a lot of fraud and misuse can take place.
Such comments raise concerns about the possibility of a looming crisis. A report by Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project says there is a risk that armed right-wing militia groups may be a source of violence on Election Day and after that. Pro-Trump militia groups have time and again said they will move to an open rebellion if their favorite man does not stay in power. Opinion polls suggest Joe Biden is leading the race, but in swing states, the Democratic candidate's domination is not that solid. Early voting totals have already surpassed 91 million, which is roughly 65% of the 139 million votes cast in 2016. It means that the massive early turnout essentially guarantees that for the first time in history, a majority of ballots will be cast before Election Day.
Elsewhere, top U.S. health expert Anthony Fauci has issued an urgent plea for change in Washington's policy on the coronavirus pandemic. In an interview with the Washington Post, Fauci warned that the United States is headed for, quote, a whole lot of hurt. Unless it makes an abrupt change in its health practices, he said the country could not possibly be positioned more poorly ahead of the cold weather and the flu season. But the White House rejected the warning as unacceptable and against all norms, accusing Fauci of choosing to play politics just before the election. Trump insists the country is rounding the turn on the virus, even as over 9.2 million Americans have contracted COVID-19 and more than 230,000 have died of it. Colin Campbell says Donald Trump is trying to downplay the severity of the COVID-19 crisis in the U.S.
He's on a pretty much a campaign trying to disprove how serious COVID-19 is. And of course, this is because he wanted to spell out the narrative that there is really nothing serious affecting America, and that our economy is strong, everybody's doing well, and that people were essentially better now than they were 4 years ago. But the opposite is true. We have a lot of people who have died from COVID-19. We have a floundering economy. We have a general feeling of malaise as people are tired of the up and down of Washington politics, being sequestered and quarantined, and still the rate of infections has gone up. The cases of coronavirus cases have gone up. And of course, the huge loss of jobs as people file for unemployment. An estimated 750,000 people filed for unemployment just last week alone. And because the number of cases continues to rise in the country, many people don't believe that the economy will bounce back to the pre-COVID-19 levels for the next several months or so.
More European countries are imposing fresh restrictions as coronavirus infections and deaths keep surging across the continent. Germany has ordered a round of shutdowns until the end of the month. People have been asked to remain at homes while cafes and restaurants, as well as theaters, operas, and cinemas, would remain closed. Tighter lockdown rules are also set in Belgium, which has the most COVID-19 cases per capita in the world. Portugal, too, has ordered a partial lockdown. Starting Wednesday, England is preparing for fresh stay-at-home orders following in the steps of Austria, France, and Ireland. Spain has already imposed a nighttime curfew in almost all of its regions, have implemented border closures. Italy is also expected to announce new restrictions. Europe accounted for half of the COVID-19 cases globally last week, with an average of over 240,000 cases per day. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter with our guests. Let's hear what they had to say.
Saeed, Europe is a small continent, but accounts for half of the COVID-19 infections. Tell us about where you are now in the UK, how strict the restrictions are, and how we will well people are observing those restrictions.
Good to be with you, Behrouz. Well, we heard over the past 24 hours the UK government come out and announce a new lockdown. It comes after what they refer to as the tiered system, obviously a fail, an acknowledgement of that failing. But what observers are saying is that the whole of Europe has gone from taking a whack-a-mole strategy, a game we've all played, to a sledgehammer strategy. Whack-a-mole strategy being tiered system, localized lockdowns in countries such as the UK, France, Germany, and others have tried. That obviously didn't work, and now they went for the so-called, quote-unquote, nuclear option. In the case of the United Kingdom, cases have been rising rapidly recently. There was pressure on the government from certain quarters of power, including the opposition Labour Party, for the government to go through a circuit breaker, which would have meant the announcement of a two-week or three-week national lockdown to curb the fast spread of this very infectious, very deadly virus. They resisted the pressure at the time, but yesterday we heard them come out and actually announce a national lockdown for 4 weeks, which will continue until the 2nd of December. Even so, people are asking, will the government be able to bring the country out of the lockdown at the end of December? By the 2nd of December. A lot of people are saying that is not probably going to happen. And this morning, Michael Gove, one of the government officials, said that it is possible that the government might extend the one-month national lockdown even further. What is important also to mention is that the spread of the virus depends a lot on people's behavior, as to your question, whether or not people are observing the rules and regulations. I can't speak for everybody or the entire country, but definitely there are people who cannot. I've been watching local television, for example, that yesterday the country was celebrating Halloween, but there was a correspondent in Liverpool, for example, which is in Tier 3, one of the three levels, alert levels, and there were young people and others out there and really not bothered with observing the law, which would have meant, you know, staying at 2 meters apart, wearing their masks and observing social distancing rules. So not everybody is observing the rules announced by the government, and probably that explains why we are looking at a fast rise of infections. As a matter of fact, Imperial College London, just this past week, right in the lead up to this massive announcement, estimated that around 96,000 people were getting COVID-19 every day. Just do the math, and that what would have meant if they hadn't allowed this lockdown by the end of November, Behrouz.
Exactly. Okay, now let's turn to the Vienna. Homa, tell us what the situation is like there in Austria.
Yes, hello. Well, yesterday we saw an important press conference here in Vienna with the Chancellor, the health minister and the interior minister announcing a second lockdown. Now, it's not as strict as the lockdown that we saw in spring, in March, when the rise in infections began in Austria, but it is based on the German model that's been announced in Germany, and it is expected to continue for 4 weeks. Now, this model means that all restaurants and bars and pubs, etc., will be closed. Only shops and those that are needed for essential services will be open. Hotels will be closed. And also schools and kindergartens for now are open, but students above the age of 14 will have to switch to distance learning. So there is it's not as strict as it was before, but the measures are strict in themselves. And we have seen a lot of public resistance to these measures in Austria as well. Just a few days ago, demonstrations were held in the city center here with people saying that they do not want to abide by these restrictions, and themselves not wearing masks, not, as Saeed was saying, they're observing these public social distancing rules. But there are also another group of people in Austria saying that the government is not taking enough strict measures. So it is a confusing situation for people here. But what the government was saying in the press conference is that the numbers are rising exponentially. So we had, for instance, yesterday, the announcement that more than 5,200 new cases were reported in Austria, and that is five times the number that was announced just 2 weeks before.
Right.
So this is a situation that the country is concerned that the health authorities cannot cope with, that the intensive care units, the capacity will be reached soon, and then there will be a catastrophe where they say that the health authorities should choose between patients who to save and who to leave, you know?
Right.
So this is a very worrying situation in terms of what the infections are saying.
Yeah, Homa, but compared to other places like France, you're still better off compared to other parts of Europe. Hopefully, authorities and people themselves will try to do something about it and take it seriously and get rid of this disease. Okay, Said, Homa, stay safe, take good care of yourselves. We had Said Kureza from London and Homa Lesky joining us from Vienna.
Elsewhere, Iran's National Coronavirus Task Force has imposed travel restrictions between 25 provinces to curb the spread of the virus across the country. The restrictions are scheduled to take effect at noon on Monday. Officials have warned that those refusing to observe the curbs will be charged with penalty fines. The government has also announced a series of new restrictions, including the closure of some public spaces. The measures come amid a growing number of coronavirus-related infections and deaths in Iran. On Sunday, the country reported its highest daily number of fatalities with 434 deaths. That figure brought Iran's total COVID-19 death toll to over 35,000, where total infections stand at more than 620,000. Elsewhere, the death toll from Friday's powerful earthquake in the western Turkish city of Izmir rises to 81. Turkish authorities say 79 people lost their lives in Izmir, while two others died in the Greek island of Samos. Rescue efforts are underway to find the remaining survivors beneath the debris. Turkey's Disaster and Emergency Authority says over 960 people were injured in the earthquake. The rescue groups have provided over 3,500 tents and 13,000 beds to temporarily shelter the victims. A powerful 7-magnitude tremor rocked Turkey and Greece on Friday, causing a lot of damage. Tens of thousands of people have once again marched in the Belarusian capital to demand President Alexander Lukashenko leave power. Police fired warning shots and used stun grenades to disperse protesters. More than 200 people were arrested. Demonstrators have flooded the capital for 12 straight weeks since August, when Lukashenko won the presidential election in a landslide. The opposition candidate, who has since fled the country, says the vote was rigged. Several people have died in the post-election violence. Lukashenko, who was backed by Russia, has accused the U.S. of inciting violence in the country. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
everyone, this is John. You're with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on few of the most critical, sensitive, and important issues in the subcontinent, a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's dive into our segment, break down issues, take expert opinion, and see what people say. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we shall look into China-Pakistan economic belt. Also, we will explore India's fight against digital colonization.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC, is a multi-billion dollar infrastructure development project intended to connect Asia with Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. It was officially launched in April 2015 while China's President Xi Jinping visited Pakistan with an estimated cost of about $46 billion. Then the two governments drew up a long-term plan starting in 2017 and drastically expanded the projected timeline for implementation up to 2030. Projected costs ballooned to $62 billion, but Pakistani officials have since mentioned even higher numbers.
Pakistan is struggling with persistent security issues and infrastructure shortages. Therefore, attracting foreign investment is truly difficult. This is when old friend China enters the stage with unexpected largesse to strengthen their ties. Ties once described higher than the Himalayas, deeper than the deepest ocean, and sweeter than honey. Naturally, Islamabad accepts the helping hand, and Pakistan becomes a natural location for China to pilot its ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC, launched in 2015 to address Pakistan's persistent power sector and infrastructure woes, is the most developed section of the Belt and Road Initiative to date, connecting western China with the Arabian Sea via Balochistan. For Pakistan, the project is advertised as a game-changer that will take Pakistan to new heights of prosperity because of the numerous opportunities it promised to create. But for China, the stakes seem to be even higher because the project is a showcase for the promises or perils of the mother project to other countries. If China succeeds in this part, garnering support for the Belt and Road Initiative may become more realizable.
Since the Chinese President Xi Jinping launched the initiative in 2013, the World Bank estimates about $575 billion worth of energy plants, railways, roads, ports, and other projects have been built or are in the process of being worked all across the globe. Islamabad hopes to use the Chinese capital, production capacity, and know-how from the project in order to upgrade the country's infrastructure and build a mechanism for sustainable growth development. In return, Beijing gained the connection to the Arabian Sea, providing the contingency trade route to the risk-prone Malacca Strait. The narrow stretch of water between the Malay Peninsula and the Indonesian island of Sumatra is the main shipping lane between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean.
Apart from a patchy portrayal of feasibility for the Belt and Road Initiative, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is supposed to serve another agenda for Beijing. Through financing the project, China aims to promote its currency, a goal failed so far as all of the transactions have been made in US dollars instead of yuan. Of course, it was Pakistan, not China, that initially pushed for jettisoning the greenback. Recently, however, there has been a renewed push to look for alternatives to dollar-based project financing and expansion of the renminbi in Sino-Pakistani cross-border trade. Last fall, the two countries announced that renminbi would replace dollar to finance all future energy and transport projects placed under the CPEC umbrella. Pakistan is a flagship for China's Belt and Road, so the need to show progress is crucial, but the progress is increasingly slowing down, if not paralyzed, as some think tanks label it. Why? Probably because BRI's practicality is undermined by accusations that China is luring poor countries into debt traps for its own gain. Pakistan's cluttered political economy, austerity measures imposed by the International Monetary Fund, and now COVID-19 have been other hurdles in the way of the project.
Now for more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shakil Ahmed Rameh, who is a political economist. Mr. Rameh, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what does China-Pakistan economic corridor mean for the relations between Pakistan and China? What would it bring for both the countries?
First of all, Pakistan and China say each other iron brother. So this is a terminology which both countries don't use for any other country. So there you can see how much importance they give to each other. Second thing, so CPEC and China and relationship, they are bringing enormous opportunities for Pakistan and China. First of all, in case of Pakistan, so before launch of the CPEC, Pakistan was going through energy crunch. Every year, Pakistan was losing $4 to $5 billion due to load shedding of electricity. There was huge demand for the road and transport infrastructure. Pakistan needed $1.2 billion to rehabilitate the transport sector, but Pakistan did not have the resources. On top of that, Pakistan was going through the war on terror, and no country, and even our allies, they were not offering us any type of investment and any type of help to overcome these challenges. In this case, China came forward to help us. Or for China, through CPEC route, if China only do trade with the six countries, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Netherlands, Germany, France, China can save $70 billion in the transportation. That's why it is called a win-win cooperation.
Okay, what is the significance of the China-Pakistan economic corridor for India?
If India become part of CPEC, India can fulfill its dream of connectivity towards Afghanistan and to Central Asia. You know that India always look for the transit trade through Pakistan to reach Afghanistan and Central Asia, but they have problem. Being a part of CPEC, they can utilize the CPEC rule to do the trade with the Afghanistan and the Central Asian state. On other side, if India joined the BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, through another corridor, Bangladesh, China, Myanmar, and India, so they can officially create link with the CPEC, so they can again use the CPEC route by using the BRI to go for the transit trade with the Central Asia and with Afghanistan. One thing and second thing, India needs huge investment for its infrastructure. As we know that there is a problem of infrastructure, there is a problem. When I talk about the infrastructure, it does not only mean road infrastructure, something like that. It also includes education infrastructure, health infrastructure, and other services infrastructure. But India is not able to put forward that money. So they need some assistance from the other country. So it will also bring these opportunities for India to benefit from BRI and also from the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, which has been hosted by China.
Mr. Rameh, our team has collected some global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could take a look, and then we can continue with the question and answer session.
The reality is that much of CPEC, like the Belt and Road more broadly, has been paralyzed, said Jonathan Hillman, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, referring to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Pakistan is a flagship for China's Belt and Road, so the need to show progress is even more important. China needed a country to showcase its BRI initiative. Pakistan seemed the obvious choice. It was China's only real ally, a security partner, or a vulnerable flank. Meanwhile, a new prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, and his business-friendly Pakistan Muslim League had just come to power, pledging big infrastructure projects and an end to the country's notorious brownouts.
Welcome back, Mr. Rameh, and thank you to the audience as well for staying with us. So, can this project be used to counter the hegemony of the US dollar?
Look, to counter the hegemony, it will take time, at least 3 to 4 decades. China wants to work with the global system, but definitely, as the time will go on, China will be the strongest country in the term of economy and its outreach to the BRI. But definitely, when they will be the hub of all the economic activities, people will prefer to work with the Chinese currency instead of with US currency.
There are reports of this project being delayed. So, what is the reason for the delay of the implementation of this project?
Project is going well. But there are certain challenges of the problem which project is facing from the day one. First of all, the external challenges, the propaganda by the West, especially led by USA and India. Because USA never wanted Pakistan to be the part of the CPAC. That's why they're using a different tools, including FATF. So they have put Pakistan in a gray list by using one way and another way. So it can hinder the investment in the Pakistan. Second thing, that Indians dream of the regional hegemony. It's also creating problem for the Pakistan because Pakistan is not ready to accept the India as a hegemonic power in the region. And other thing is on the internal level. So in the internal level, so the political parties, they are busy to take the credit of the CPAC. If you talk to any political party of the Pakistan, they say, oh, it's due to us. But the reality is that China built this relationship with all the governments from 1952 onward. So this CPAC corridor is a result of the continuous work of all the political parties and the institutions from the both sides, which is from China and Pakistan. So nobody can take a credit. But due to this credit game, so when somebody is not in the government, they start to raise the questions, which impact, definitely they are the part of the parliament. So it's impact the speed of a CPAC. But alhamdulillah, at this point of time, CPAC is going very well. With the creation of the CPAC authority, the speed has been accelerated. We are witnessing every day a new project and a new dimensions in the CPAC. The CPAC has been expanded in the area of agriculture, cooperation, and science and technology.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ramey, for being with us on our show. Let's see how people on social media see the situation now.
As the spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Li Jianzhao considers the CPEC project as the flagship of the BRI and believes that it has boosted Pakistan's economy and regional connectivity. Imtiaz Butt believes that CPEC plays an important role in expanding trade potential by connecting China to other parts of Asia and also the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf. The official account of the CPEC project refers to the report published by the State Bank of Pakistan that China has poured $103.6 million during the first quarter of the ongoing fiscal year, consolidating its first position as topmost FDI country in Pakistan.
Colonialism means when a country seeks to extend or retain its authority over other people or territories. Now that the age is digital, control over how technology works is the foundation of colonialism. Western big tech firms are reinventing colonialism through the domination of digital technology, exercising imperial control at the architectural level of the digital ecosystem. The current state of affairs is reminiscent of the European colonial era prior to World War I, but the actors have swapped roles. Now the US is exerting global power instead of European superpowers, and digital China is playing the role of the US.
Following the era of politico-military colonization from which countries like India were liberated from the 1945 onwards, colonialism was changing its focus on digital or technological progress. Digital colonialism is rooted in the design of the tech ecosystem for the purposes of profit and plunder. The drivers of colonialism have always been economic, and it signifies the extraction of disproportionate economic benefit from an area of influence through either manipulation of the rules of engagement or through force or deceit. Under classic colonialism, Europeans via corporations like the East India Company took ownership and control of critical infrastructure, including ports, waterways, and railroads. They dispossessed indigenous people of their land, exploited their labor, and perpetuated dependency through strategic underdevelopment. But in the digital age, the rich in the West had to figure out another mechanism to continue to maintain a way to extract disproportionate economic benefits. Therefore, they tried to construct an intellectual monopoly through numerous restrictive information technology structures.
Exploitation of the colonies has never been limited to the economic plunder, but also the intellectual plunder. The West has been constantly trying best to keep knowledge and technology away from the rest of the world. Winner-take-all economics is the reason that the companies in the US and China are able to take advantage of large domestic markets. Meanwhile, India, rather than being pursued by France and Britain, is now the object of attention of both the United States and China. Now, big foreign tech firms are investing in India and taking over the local market. This means a takeover of information infrastructure, a degradation of India's own local tech products, and more neo-colonization.
In their pursuit of profit and power, the rapidly advancing frontier of digital empire is holding the world hostage to a vicious cycle. Western companies create new technologies, then introduce new standards around those technologies through global sci-tech standards and conformity assessment bodies such as IEEE or the International Electrotechnical Commission. This gives them the monopoly rent, a guarantee that they stay above the competitive market at the expense of consumers. Challenging the technology hegemony of the West, China stepped in to disrupt the situation but joined the club and stayed there. Taiwan has become not just a geopolitical issue, but an important outpost for maintaining the structures of digital colonization, as the bulk of the global semiconductors are manufactured in Taiwan using US technology. India, with its massive and growing online populations, needs to review the strategies and regulations for breaking into the technology hegemony of the West or of China. Digital colonialism is a serious threat, not only for India and the global South, but also the entire world. The international community needs to create a fundamentally different tech ecosystem to decentralize technological advances by placing control directly into the hands of the people.
To learn more about this issue, we are joined by Mr. Prabir Purkayastha. He's the co-convener of the JustNet Coalition, which is a global network of civil society actors. Mr. Purkayastha, welcome to the show. So, what is at risk? Why is it so important to stand up against digital colonization?
See, if you look at the companies today, the largest companies by what's called market capital, which is how capitalism measures the size of companies, today are digital monopolies. So effectively, it's the Facebook, it's Google, it's Apple, it's Amazon, and also Microsoft, the five biggies, who essentially are the top of the heap in terms of size and the amount of capital they can generate. The question is, where is this money coming from? Why is it they're so valuable? And it transpires that they, in fact, have our data. Most of them have our data, particularly Facebook and Google, who really are hoovering data from all across the world and have access to it. And of course, that access means they're able to sell us various things. They're able to use essentially us to the advertisers. And that's where they make the big money from. So we may think that we are getting a free service. What we are giving is essentially our data to them, and also our eyeballs, our attention. And this then can be sold to the advertisers who give, of course, Google and Facebook money. That's really destroying the media in most parts of the world, because Google and Facebook do not generate content. It's the rest of us who do. And that content is what they use in order to get our attention, our eyeballs. And this, somebody has called it attention capital, but essentially it's us being sold as commodities to the advertisers. This is really Google and Facebook's business model.
So what can India do to break the technological hegemony of the West and the big tech?
You see, there are two ways of looking at this. And unfortunately, most of the world may be looking at it the wrong way. The way India seems to be going is, well, we keep the Chinese out because the relationship with India and China have broken down, particularly after clashes in the north. So, but they do not see that instead of China or United States, we could promote not Indian big capital, which is what they're doing at the moment, which is what a lot of countries in the world are doing, but promote public utilities, which says service like search engine, services like, Gmail, all of this should be used as public utilities. They should be, at best, if they're in private hands, they need to be regulated strongly, or they should be broken up. They cannot be allowed to be monopolies. Instead of that, what we are saying, instead of having their monopolies, we should try and build ours. Now, when you try that, these Indian, for instance, Indian big capital is willing to be built up by the government, but at the same time, it also wants money from Google, Facebook to invest and become partners. So this logic will not work. All it will do is it will deliver us as well to Indian big capital along with their partners. So in this case, unlikely to be big MNCs, big capital tech companies from abroad. And that's what we exactly see happening in India today.
Before asking the next question, let's see the media views regarding this problem, and then we can continue.
Big tech corporations use proprietary software, corporate clouds, and centralized internet services to spy on users, process their data, and spit back manufactured services to subjects of their data fiefdoms. For example, Google siphons user data from a variety of sources, Google Search, Maps, Ads, Android Location Services, Gmail, to provide them with one of the richest collections of information on the planet. Just as oil-producing nations push for oil refineries to add value to crude oil, so governments today want the world's big tech companies to build data centers on their own soil. While India is the country with the biggest amount of Facebook users, when you look at the location of Facebook's 15 data centers, 10 are in North America, 4 in Europe, and 1 in Asia, in Singapore.
All right, thank you for staying with us. So, how successful do you think India has been in this? And what else needs to be done?
So India's success is it has been able to build up a couple of Indian capitalist concerns into a certain size. And this size they have built is really based on currently, essentially, the telecommunication monopoly. One of the companies which is started as an oil company, it's now got into telecommunications, has built up a monopoly virtually. It's become the leading telecommunication company, mobile as well as internet, as well as other things. So what it has done is say, okay, we are the biggest players in India on how we access people. So everybody has to align with me, otherwise I'll cut your access out. So that is a leverage, but that's a limited success because the future lies not in the access alone. But what do you do with the access? And that's really access to the people through various services that exist. And of course, the data, because if they have our data, they know us much better than anybody else. The joke is that the Google and Facebooks know us better than our parents do, mothers do. And therefore, they can sell or use us for business purposes. And that is not provided by just simply providing access. So in effect, we are already handing over our data and all the tools that they are using to such companies, and as a result, the Indian capitalists may get a cut, but they're not going to be able to dominate the market. The market will be dominated by those who have the data and who develop services based on that data.
Mr. Pukhayastha, thank you for being with us on our show. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Pursana Viswanathan suggests that the Indian government needs to make the giant tech companies understand that they can't intervene in the country's affairs. Vijay Shekhar Sharma also believes that the Indians should try to get independence from the dominance of Google. According to Ellen Barry, although India seems to be a great market for the tech giants, its leaders are cautious about these companies.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the CPEC issue. Our team works really hard to make sure that you enjoy the show. We'll meet the same day next week.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Allah. first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam by Tahir Reza Jafar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Welcome to another episode of For Humanity, a program wherein we look at the beautiful treatise of rights, Risalatul Huquq, of our fourth Imam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. We have been discussing the right of one's wealth or haqqul mal, and we note that the Imam alayhi salam tells us that just like everything else we interact with in this world, our wealth, our possessions also have a right upon us. And of course, when we are talking about the right of one's wealth, the first thing that comes to mind and that the Imam alayhi salam also mentions is how we earn our wealth. So the Imam alayhi salam says, فَأَنْ لَا تَأْخُذَهُ إِلَّا مِنْ حِلِّهِ. That means that you make sure that you do not earn your wealth except through lawful means. This is very important because it is easy to earn wealth through unlawful means as well. There are many examples of unlawfully acquired wealth. Wealth that is acquired through cheating, through gambling, through stealing, even through interest, which is haram. Certain kinds of interest or riba in Islam is haram. And so these kinds of wealth, taking the possessions of others without their permission, for example, which is known as ghasb, to usurp the rights of others, the possessions of others. All these kinds of acquisition of wealth are unlawful acquisition. So the right of your possession, the first and foremost right that the Imam alayhi salam mentions, is that you must acquire it lawfully. And of course, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi tells us, أَزْكَ الْمَالْ مَكْتُسِبَ مِنْ حِلِّهِ. The most pure of your wealth, the purest of your wealth, is that which has been earned lawfully. And so, if you are a person who does not care about how you acquire wealth, and many people unfortunately only think about the bank balance and how much they have in their possession, not how they acquired it. Imam alayhi salam says the first right of your wealth is for you to consider how you have acquired it and how you are acquiring it. Are you acquiring your wealth through halal means or not? Because if you are acquiring a lot of wealth but through unlawful means, then rest assured that you will be giving up your hereafter. And that is why we find in the traditions we are told, مَنْ اِكْتَسَبَ مَالًا مِنْ غَيْرِ حِلِّهِ أَضَرَّ بِآخِرَتِهِ. One who earns wealth unlawfully is actually destroying his hereafter. Because of course we know that the hereafter is a place where there is no opportunity for you to make amends for these kinds of mistakes. You cannot tell yourself, when I get there, I will see. No, by the time you are raised in the hereafter, then all your actions of this world are what will determine whether you will go to Jannah or to the fire of hell. and there is no action, and there is no ransom that you can give to change your position. And that is why we are told, إِنَّ الْيَوْمَ عَمَلٌ وَلَا حِسَابٌ وَغَدًا حِسَابٌ وَلَا عَمَلٌ. Indeed, today there is all sorts of deeds that you can perform, good deeds and bad deeds, without accounting. But tomorrow, on the day of judgment, there will be accounting, but there will be no deeds that you can perform. And so it is very important that while a person may see that he or she is able to get away with acquiring unlawful wealth, because we know that in the world today, in secular states, many of these unlawful incomes are actually considered legal. But in Islam, they are unlawful. If gambling is permitted in certain countries, that does not make it permissible in Islam. If interest is permitted in certain countries, that does not make it permissible in the eyes of Allah Azza wa Jal. And hence, it is important for us to realize that when we are talking about acquiring the wealth, we need to acquire it through lawful means, because even though there is no accountability in this world, apparently, but there will be accountability in the hereafter. And then, if we have acquired something unlawfully, then we are going to be held accountable for it. And then the Imam alayhi salam says, once you have acquired your wealth legally and lawfully, then you have to spend it lawfully. That is very important, because you may have acquired it lawfully, but if you spend your wealth in haram things, in unlawful things, in forbidden things, then again you will have done something that goes against the right of your wealth. And the Imam says, وَلَا تُنْفِقَهُ إِلَّا فِي حِلِّ. Now that you have acquired it فِي حِلِّ lawfully, then do not spend it except in that which is lawful. And very interestingly, Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam says, مَنْ يَكْتَسِبَ مَالًا مِنْ غَيْرِ حِلِّهِ يَصْرِفُهُ فِي غَيْرِ حِلِّ. Or يَصْرِفُهُ فِي غَيْرِ حَقِّهِ. So, the Imam says, one who acquires wealth unlawfully ends up spending it unlawfully, or ends up spending it where it is not meant to be spent. And so there is a connection between acquiring the wealth lawfully and spending it lawfully. If we do both of these, we acquire it lawfully and spend it lawfully, then we will have fulfilled part of the right of our wealth. Insha'Allah, we will continue this discussion in the next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity by Brother Tahir Reza Jafar. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is His messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English.